Thanks for downloading this podcast. There are hundreds more just like it at abc.net.au/conversations, and we're on iTunes as well.
How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that were the case?
Oh, no, so that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day,
I will never accept
it. It was
that.
Like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And
look, I don't know, it's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Years and years ago, people from all over the world came to Australia. They pushed their belongings out into the remote reaches of the country, and they built farms, and they worked on cattle stations, and they cut sugarcane and set up shops. At night, they were often lonely and a bit spooked by all the quiet. So they brought out whatever musical instruments they'd brought with them from the old country, and they made themselves merry or sad, and they made each other laugh, and they danced or told stories to each other. Well, my guest today is Rob Willis. Rob's an actual Australian folklorist. And Rob's been travelling around Australia for decades, recording these old songs and stories before they disappear for good. Rob loves what he does, and his easygoing manner is ideally suited for drawing these stories and songs from people who seem to be able to relive them so vividly. Rob's recordings are a precious national resource, and they're held by the National Library, and now they're online for everyone to watch and marvel at. And he's still doing it even today. Rob Willis, welcome to Conversations.
Hello, Richard.
Hello. Lovely to have you here, Rob. Tell me why you wanted to begin to capture local folk music for a start. Is any of this stuff written down?
No, it's mainly in the oral tradition. And I was born and raised in Forbes, and I'm still there and very proud to be there in New South Wales. And we were surrounded by history. We had Ben Hall and Kate Kelly buried in the local cemetery. And all these amazing old musicians that were still alive that I didn't realise, because sometimes we don't look in our own backyard.
Tell me about the process of how they've changed these songs. They'd sort of pop up somewhere and then they'd evolve like a Chinese whispers process, wouldn't they?
Yeah, that's it. And what would happen, because a lot of these people that I've spoken with couldn't even read or write, let alone read or write music, so it's all in the oral tradition. And it's like if Richard learns a yarn and he passes it on to Pam, the producer, you both put a little bit onto it, and then Rob comes along and he listens to it. It's the same with a folk song, or an old song, as I like to call them, a yarn, a dance tune, a dance itself. And all we are doing is taking a snapshot at a particular time. It will continue to evolve as it has evolved before up to that point. And this is what fascinated me, that these people had all these stories and songs and all the rest of that, the dances, but what's going to happen to them? They're going to be lost. So I grabbed my trusty old cassette tape recorder, much to the chagrin of the archivists now, and started to record them.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's to their chagrin at all, because at least you got them. I mean, that's great. You had state-of-the-art technology as it was back then. It strikes me what you're doing there. It's not the culture you're capturing here is not a million miles different from Aboriginal storytelling and an Indigenous oral tradition.
Yeah, that's very, very true. It's the same thing. A lot of people, and the bush is my backyard. It's where I love to be, and the people of the bush. And it is, because of Australia's isolation, these little pockets of cultural areas would spring up. If there was an Irish area, it would have the remainder of the Irish. You'd have a German area. You'd have all these other areas, Scottish areas, and their traditions were changed and evolved into whatever happened to be in the area.
Can you hear homesickness for the old country in a lot of these old songs?
There's a lot of... funny you should mention that, because I did a paper for the School of Music in Canberra just before the National Folk Festival at Easter, and it was on Australian laments. And the one that I came up with was one called The Broken Down Squatter. Come stumpy old man, let us shift while we can. And it laments the banks taking his property in the 1890s. So it reflects on that culture of the time there. And a lot of them there were these elements of the Irish and those other cultures as well.
There's a lot of humour in these songs too. Like, you know, even in the famous old poetry of Banjo Paterson, a lot of, if you kind of think yourself back to the time it was written, he was kind of a bit like what the Chaser was to his own time. The poetry, the humour that's in these things has often got this element of contemporary satire in them.
Oh, yeah, taking the Mickey Bliss out of things, yeah. And the thing about banjo, too, that was so fascinating, that he was one of Australia's first folklore collectors with his old bush songs. He was writing for the Bulletin, and he would ask people to contribute their memories of the old bush songs, and that's what his first book was called, Old Bush Songs. So Banjo Paterson, in his way, was a collector, and I think he might have put elements of these particular collected material in some of his other poems as well.
Typically, where was a lot of these old... Where were they performed? Where were they played? In houses or out in the open? Tell me about the circumstances where people would come together to hear these songs and play them.
Well, wherever people would congregate, even after a hard day's work, large families in those days, Dad would play the fiddle or the button accordion or sing a song, and the kids would absorb all of this. At dances in the old bush halls, that's the sort of thing. There'd be what they called an item, where someone, they'd play the dances and then someone would get up and give their local, their latest piece of poetry or something like that as well.
It's called an item, was it?
They called an item.
An item. Isn't that lovely?
So, would you like to do an item, Richard?
Well, yes, sir. I've got here something, a recording you made on Super 8 film from the 1980s, and here you are sitting talking to this lovely old man, and he's playing a button accordion on a log, and you're sitting next to him. Just have a listen to this.
What beat me when you're first doing it is to have your bellows the right thing to get it. I used to practice for hours. Might have meant to say, sometimes when I'd start, by the time I got the tremolo and done, the bellows would be closed up. So I used to have to just work it, you know, like...
Now he's sitting under a gum tree on a log, and you're sitting next to him as he's. What do you remember about him and what speaking to him that day?
Oh, you couldn't ever forget Dave. He taught me how to play the button accordion. So Dave was one of life's little characters. He lost his sight. He did have a bit of sight, but he was legally blind. And his thing in life was his music, and he played the mouth organ and the button accordion quite well for dancers, and told very risque Dad and Dave jokes. But no, Dave was again one of these wonderful old characters, and I'll never forget Dave.
Where is this taking place? What part of Australia?
In Forbes.
In Forbes?
Yes. Yeah, this was in Forbes, out on the local gum tree.
What's really interesting hearing him, and he must have been in his 70s or 80s when you spoke to him, and that's... So he was someone who was probably born at the turn of the 20th century or thereabouts. Is his language, too? You can hear him use those old Australian phrases like, I mean to say.
Yes.
The interesting syntax where things sort of... Carts get before the horses and the front and back of sentences and all that. How does that change when you go from region to region?
Oh, extremely. I love this. I love this, Richard. I love people say that Australia doesn't have regional dialects, but by goodness, we do. I think I'm going to do a bit of a grasshopper here and flick over to the west coast of Tasmania. And I was recording the stories of the piners, the Huon piners. And I said, how did you get the logs out of the bush? And he said, oh, with a take-all. And I said, sorry? He said, with a take-all, Rob, with a take-all. You know, a block and take-all.
Like, are you an idiot?
Yes.
Everyone's heard of a block and take-all.
Block and tackle. The other one was, you're doing the washing. Oh, yes, we put him in the trough. The what? The trough, the trough. It's the pronunciation. So, yes, we do have these regional dialects. And Dave is a good example of this and that Australianism. This ochreism, I've never heard it in 30-odd years of recording, this strine that we talk about. I've never heard that. But Dave Mathias's way of talking is pretty typical.
Now, that's from Forbes. Yep. He was from Forbes. Do people still speak that, like that? Or is that kind of the more generic Australian accent now kind of everywhere in Australia?
It's generic, I think, because of technology. Again, I talk about this regional business, but now we don't have that regionalism because we're listening to the radio or we're watching the television or we've got our iPhone or something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of old phrases have died out as well, like, strike me pink.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
You don't hear that anymore. Yeah. I don't know if I want to strike anyone pink, to be honest. But
I love Flash. You know, he's a Flash bloke.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
Cobber.
Yeah.
In Tasmania again. Ah, oh, g'day, Cobber. Love it.
I remember my grandfather came out in a striped shirt once and he said, what do you reckon? And I said, oh, it looks all right. He said, you don't reckon I look like a lair, do you? Lair. I've known that one for a long time. Or a cove. Yeah.
Flash is a rat with a gold tooth.
Flash is a rat with a gold tooth, indeed. Now, my producer rang you and you noticed you had a sore throat. Now, you're full of folk remedies too that you've been able to pick up. What's the remedy you heard for a sore throat?
I'm full of a lot of things, Richard. I think I've cured Pam, your producer, actually.
Yeah. Yeah,
she's nodding away there. It was a lovely grab that I had from a lady. I forget where she came from. But it was painting the throat with iodine, but you had to use a chook feather. And don't try this at home, kiddies.
The chook feather. Yeah. Oh, that's lovely. Now, you grew up in Forbes, as you said. What was your childhood like? Were you a farm boy or a country town boy?
No, I was a country town boy. And very much so. And my parents owned a jewellery shop in Forbes. I was born in 1944. There we go. And we lived right in the centre of town. And my backyard was a lane. And in that lane, there was the Greek cafe across the road. The local pub was there. And a set of tenancies that had a lot of refugees there. So even growing up in a small town like Forbes, I was exposed to all these different characters. And I don't know whether that's what whet my appetite to do what I do, but I think it might have, because the Greek kids were my best friends. And the local drunk had come in and we'd sit down and have a yarn. And there was old Percy the Yardman over at the pub who was an eye specialist in World War One. He peeled potatoes. So this is the sort of characters that, you know, that you meet.
So they're a town of gifted storytellers, in other words.
That yes.
You didn't have a TV, I'm guessing, in Forbes in those days. That's what would keep you entertained.
Yes, yeah.
Where did you sit on the Protestant-Catholic divide? Because that was important back in those days. Where were you?
a bit of a mixture there, because I was actually born Robert Kevin Breen, and I think my Irishness still comes through to some degree, I hope so. But my parents separated just after I was born.
Gee, that must have been a big deal in those days, in a country town.
Oh, yes, it was. It was the big thing. I mean, my mother reflected on it later. But the point was that my father, as my mum used to call him, was Black Irish and a Catholic. And Forbes was a Catholic town, and Parkes, 20 mile away in the old money, was a very Protestant town.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah. So they put me in the car, my grandmother and my mother, they took me to Parkes, to the High Church of England, and had me baptised. And I think I've been back into a church once or twice since then. But it was there all the time, yes. That was quite common amongst the shearing industry and amongst a whole lot of people.
My guest in conversation today is Rob Willis. Rob's an Australian folklorist. He's been collecting stories, songs, humour from Australians from the old culture, I suppose that's the best way to put it, over many, many decades now. And the stuff he's been able to collect on cassette recorder and Super 8 film and video and digital recordings are now available for you at the National Library there. They're a bit of a precious national resource. What was your mum doing at the time? What kind of a business was she running?
Oh, we ran the jewellery business at my grandparents established in Forbes about 1915, I think, and they ran, mum took it over. And that's basically where I was raised, in the house above the shop.
Did you have a career in mind as a boy? What were you aiming
at? Oh, when I got to high school, I was very taken with the military. My grandfather had been in the Australian Flying Corps, and my stepfather, was in Z Special, which was the commando units in New Guinea.
Did they tell stories when they got back, or were they dead quiet about the whole thing?
Dead quiet. Yeah, that's something that I've touched on later within my talks with people. Is people the diggers talked at a later time, but not at that particular time. But that sort of got me going as far as the military was concerned, and I did my leaving certificate and applied for the Royal Military College. But this was before Vietnam, and I think my blood was the wrong colour; it wasn't blue. And I got accepted by the Officer Cadet School in Portsea, which you come out as a second lieutenant. But then I discovered wine, women and song.
And what then? What happened then once you discovered wine, women and song?
I had a bloody good time, actually. And it got to the stage, though, that the wine or the grog was starting to take over my life. I got married at about 19 or 20, I think it was, and had three children from that marriage. And the grog was starting to take over my life. It was a booze culture in small country towns, and it was dictating what I did. I started out as a television technician. Then I went into fixing washing machines. And then I got involved in sales and working in management with Burns Philp, who had country stores at that time. And towards the latter part of that particular marriage, I was drinking in the morning and that sort of thing, which, of course, led to the destruction of the marriage.
Yeah, that's how it starts, isn't it? You drink in the morning and then you start to nip out during lunch and and there it is.
Yeah.
Were you able to conceal it at work?
They must have known. I mean, people aren't fooled. But as often happens in these circumstances, your mates try and shield you. They can see what's going on. They know that there's something wrong. You know, you've got a smell all over you, and you're nipping out at lunchtime, and you're coming home, you're coming back, and you're sort of a little bit more enthusiastic about life, shall we say? But no, it was never bought to the point of being at something that was stopping me from working.
So it wasn't really about getting paralytic drunk. It was about just topping up, in other words.
No, I was never a binge drinker. It was just that continual level. I'd wake up in the morning, reach under, grab whatever was under the bed, have a nip, and then top myself up during the day.
How bad did it get, Rob?
Well, I got to the stage where after the breakup of the marriage that I'd moved into a little unit and I was continually drunk, even to the stage of metho and aftershave lotion.
Well, was that for monetary reasons or just was it easy to conceal?
It's pride. I didn't want to be seen as a drunk. I didn't want to go downtown and go and buy some more supplies of alcohol and people see that I was drunk. So, I mean, I would drink whatever was available. In those days, people used to give you lots of aftershave lotion for Chrissy. Old Spice was the best, with orange juice.
Oh, dear. I just wonder what it's like when you make that decision to drink aftershave.
It's you think of it. But it's an addiction.
What pulled you up?
I just didn't front up to work, and a mate of mine came and got me out of my dingy little flat, which was full of wine bottles and goodness knows what. He said, "I think you've got a problem." And his father was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went to my first AA meeting that night, 1974. And it was quite an interesting experience. I mean, you realise... It is an addiction, but I also think that I drank to be the person that I wanted other people to think that I was, rather than who I was myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, actually. It does in so many ways.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you think, that person will like me if I act in a certain way, and by drinking I can be that person. It's all rubbish. I didn't swear there. You've got to be yourself. And I think it was that realisation that... And it took a while to come. So I went to... It wasn't called rehab in 1974. It was a little place called... Or a big place called Hyderabad in Sydney, which is no longer there. And I still has me tossed why some of these people can go into rehab for 2 weeks and are cured. I'm still not cured. I haven't had a drink, but I'm still not cured. And that was an eye-opener in itself. I remember going to a meeting, it was run on the AA guidelines, going to a meeting somewhere in Sydney, and a bloke got up, and it was Barry Humphreys. And, I mean, Barry's expressed this in his book, so there's nothing about the anonymous part of it that's wrong there. So it's not just ragged old men in the gutter with a flagon. This affects all levels. And I think that's what it was. So then I had to go back to Forbes.
Yeah, he hit rock bottom. He wrote about that in several of his memoirs with his drink.
Yeah.
And then eventually quit and never had another drink.
Yep.
And when were you able to do that? At what point were you able to quit and never have another drink?
1974, that conscious decision, I believed that I could not drink again. But I did a couple of times over the years, but it was only just a bit of a nip and no, I can't do this. I can't safely drink. I can't do it. So 1974 was when I made that conscious decision not to drink.
How have you done it? What gave you this? I don't know if the strength is the right word for it, but it's an interesting question because some people succeed at this and some people don't. Why do you think you succeeded in having not having a drink up until this point?
I think it's that AA doctrine of a day at a time, that you're always have this addiction, I'm sure that's it. And again, that realization that if you're yourself, you shouldn't have to take a substance to be something else. You are who you are. And in my case, I am who I am. And if someone doesn't like me, that's their problem.
Do you have to know that or feel that?
Really? Oh, you've got to get that in your head, I think, Richard. Yeah, I don't know. That's just my way. I mean, everyone is different. Everyone handles situations in a different manner. That's just my particular way of doing it.
How about reforming yourself socially? Because, you know, it's not just an addiction. It's a cultural thing and a social thing, you know, having a drink. And people who don't want to have a drink, you know, gee, they get a lot of pressure, don't they?
Yeah.
How did you make that change socially coming out of it?
Oh, 1974. Well, coming back to a country town that had majority of country towns did have a grog culture. They knew that you weren't away for ingrown toenails, so you came back and I tried to go back into the pub, drink Platons and Dry or Orange Squash or something like that with the people that I used to mix with. They were dead boring. They might be drunks. talking utter gibberish.
I had to give up the grog for a couple of months after I got glandular fever once, and gee, it was a weird experience going into a pub and nightclub, stone cold sober. I've got to tell you, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. So then you sort of got interested in music and drama after all that. How did that happen?
I'd always had an interest in music, and at that stage, the folk revival with Peter, Paul and Mary and Kingston Trio, Bob Dylan, all that sort of thing. And I'd learnt piano as a kid. But they'd given up on me because I was an ear player. I was a lugger. And my first wife was learning guitar from the nun, so she then would teach me. So I'd get onto a couple of chords and things like that. And at school, I'd always had this love of drama. I was always involved. I played the Fairy Queen once. Yeah. And so what am I going to do? I'm back in Forbes. The local drama society. So I joined that, and we did wonderful things like Fiddler on the Roof and Camelot and a whole heap of stuff like that. And this is where this interest in folklore really came to the fore, because they opened up a tourist complex called the Lachlan Vintage Village in Forbes. And to celebrate that, we were asked to do a play called Reedy River that was written by Dick Diamond, and it was about the 1891 shearers' strike, and it had a whole stack of these old folk songs.
Yeah, now one song in particular, Reedy River. Tell me about the performance of that.
Oh, Chris Kempster's Reedy River, the song itself.
Yeah, that was part of the musical, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It was a Henry Lawson poem and put to the music by someone I actually have interviewed, Chris Kempster. And it's a lovely down in Reedy River, yeah.
What struck you about those songs? What was being expressed in the kind of thoughts and feelings that were in those songs?
There was one that was actually written for the show called The Ballad of 1891. Price of wool was rising in 1891, and it was talking about that she was Doreen Jacobs. And, here's a song that actually describes something in a very vibrant way. And it just sort of got me that there was a message in this song, that the history was being told musically. The other songs that were in that production, I think, were collected by John Meredith, who we'll come to, I'm sure. They was a whole clique of the Shears and the whole stack of stuff like that.
You were married again by this point, your second wife. Tell me how you met her.
Oh, Ollie, yeah. The vital part. The was the Year of the Woman. Women's National, International Women's
Year of the Women, yeah.
Yeah, Women's Year. And we, as the blokes of the Forbes Musical and Dramatic Society, decided that we would celebrate this by dressing up in drag. As you do.
There you go.
And I didn't have any shoes. And I wanted some women's shoes. And there was this new teacher that was up at Forbes North School. And I thought, oh, here we go. May I borrow your shoes? And they fitted. It was sort of Cinderella in reverse. And it went from there.
That is the most unusual couple get-togethers I've heard in a very long while. Isn't that lovely?
It's a great pickup line.
A great pickup line. G'day. What size are you, love? And it went from there. Oh, that's lovely. So that piqued your curiosity in Australian folk songs. And where did you go to from there with that, Rob?
We formed the Blackridge Bush Band out of the... Blackridge was the original name of Forbes. And we formed the Blackridge Bush Band. And we had to start off with 17 people and one microphone, which was fun. All guitars, I think. This is when I started to learn banjo. And we were doing all those old songs that were around, mainly from Meredith's book, Folk Songs of Australia, Volume 1.
Yeah. Now, how did you find that book?
It was readily available at that stage of the game. Meredith brought out, and I'm sure, as I say, we'll expand on John in a minute, but Volume 1 of Folk Songs of Australia was about just about the only thing that was out there.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Folklorist Rob Willis is my guest. His collection of stories from all around Australia is the largest folklore and social history collection in the National Library of Australia. Now, before we were talking about you were getting the idea to actually collect these songs and stories and talking to locals about this kind of thing. Your mentor in this was a man you mentioned before, John Meredith. Tell me about John.
He was born, in 1920. And trained in various aspects, mainly as a chemist. Very, very wise man. He became a part of that group of the Australian Communist Party. There were groups in Brisbane, John Manifold and others. And the group in Sydney were very conscious, John in particular, of preserving the songs mainly of Australia. And John bought a very, very old, or was one of the original tape recorders in the 1950s and started to go around recording these songs. I won't say stories at this stage because to buy a reel of tape would cost him a week's wages, so he was out there getting the songs. He would write the stories down, but the songs were what he was after.
Now, were these often political songs or protest songs? Coming out of the shearer strike and things
Yeah. Again, these songs that about the scabs at the 1891 shearer strikes and all these wonderful collection. And the Meredith collection was the formative collection in the oral history section at the National Library. John actually had to flog his beloved camera. He's a very keen photographer as well, so he had to flog his camera to buy the old tape recorder. And he had Paddy Pallon make up a pack so he could cart this thing around. And that was the basis of what he was doing. And I got to know him in later years, in late 70s, early 80s.
Now, so you obviously realised you had a bit of a common cause here. And tell me about your partnership and how that developed.
Well, what I'd been doing, after Reedy River, and we'd formed the Blackridge Bush Band, and I'd realised that there was a whole stack of these older musicians around Forbes. The concertina players, old Paddy Godden, I played for his 100th birthday. And he was a concertina player. So at this stage, I'm also learning instruments. I'm also picking up the button accordion and talking to Dave, picking up the concertina and going and talking to old Paddy, getting a 5-string banjo, and goodness knows how I learnt it, tuning it like a guitar or something like that. The tin whistle and all mouth organ, all these old traditional, but all by ear. I know that I'm smart enough to learn to play music, but I wanted to learn in the same way as they learnt. So I consciously made that decision that I'm going to learn orally. So I was doing this, and I would grab, as I said, my trusty old cassette tape recorder, which, by the way, now we use the latest in digital technology, field location film recorders, wonderful stuff. And I would go and plonk it down and talk to Dave or Paddy or Lionel or any of these other people about this music. And these stories would start to come out as well. So luckily I recorded those at the same time.
What was your bedside manner, so to speak, with these people getting their stories? Because there's lovely footage of you. I noticed in some of the old Super 8 footage, you just sort of plonk yourself down on a log next to these blokes, and they seem to be very comfortable talking to you.
Oh, yeah, I think it's the same thing as maybe yourself. If you're fair dinkum, people realise you're fair dinkum. You're not there for any other reason that you're interested. You're really interested in what they have and what they have to offer. There's no other reason why you're there. And you're the pupil, and they're the master. And you just, like, you're like a sponge, and you just absorb all that. They were comfortable with me.
Was there a moment where they'd go from being reticent to suddenly catching fire, as they suddenly, all this, the memories and the culture that was there in their head, just would suddenly just flare up in their eyes.
Oh, the warm-up period. Yeah, that would happen. And then you'd start to get all these wonderful stories and these old tunes. Oh, yeah, Irene Paddy would say, oh, yeah, I remember old Ernie Peasley. He had this great shot-ish. Of course, all these dance tunes, too, we were talking about the way that things change. Vasa Viennas, Polka Mazurkas, all these tunes change as well. I hear you playing a tune at a dance. I take it home and how the hell did that go? I play a bit and I grab a bit from someone else. So, again, we're taking a snapshot of all these tunes.
But that's where great culture comes from, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
A bit of this, bit of that. And
it's an amalgam of all this stuff.
It's a great, glorious mongrel of a thing, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah.
That's a lovely word.
Yeah, mongrel's a fantastic, very Australian word. Sometimes I wonder whether if there hadn't been more density or something, I don't know, the right things weren't in the right place at the right time. And all of American music comes from this process too. Country music, rhythm and blues, jazz. It comes from, you know, African vocalisation with Irish instruments and a bit of this, a bit of Germany, a bit of that, all sort of ending up in the same part of the United States.
I'm going to grasshopper a bit.
Okay,
again.
Again.
I'm going to take you up to the Nullah, which is, if you go to Kempsey, keep on going, hang a left instead of going up this way, and you come to the Nulla Nulla Valley where Slim Dusty was raised. There's about 30 houses, 30 properties, small properties within this, and there was cultures of Germans, Irish, English, and Slim Dusty, the Kirkpatrick family. And this is what Slim was raised on. The Kyle family up there were a wonderful group of old fiddlers, traditional fiddlers. And this is where Slim Dusty's music came from. I've been up there for 15 years recording the stories of the people up at the Nullah. The people that were before Slim Dusty, I mean, they're all gone now, of course. But this is the thing that made that person, and it's exactly what you're talking about, Richard, is this mongrel of a whole thing that's come together and spat out at the end this country music.
Now, Meredith was a man you loved dearly. He was
yes.
a beautiful man to you. And you formed such a great partnership going around and finding this stuff. How did you work together?
Oh, wonderfully well. And he was a cranky old bugger. And we didn't have a fight. 10 years on the road, just on 10 years. And
how did you know if he was cranky then? I mean,
I've seen him in action with other people. He was a left, never cross a left-handed man, Rob. Sinister.
So why didn't you two ever have a fight there?
I don't know, because I'm not a yes man, and we'd have good discussions, never fiery discussions, but we'd sort of find the level, and I don't know why, but it worked.
So what were you doing it for the same reasons, going around and capturing these snippets of story and song?
Yes, I'd met John at a festival, a Bush Music Festival in Sydney, and told him in my little way what I was doing in Forbes, recording these stories. And I said, look, mate, you know, I'm only doing this on cassette recorders. You've at that stage, you were using Nagras or U-hairs, I think, in those early days, recorders, reel-to-reel recorders. And John was working with the National Library. And I said, look, come up and record them. You know, I've done the prelims. You just come up and record them. And that's what he did. And John did not drive. I don't know whether he had a driver's license or not. And he relied on a group of people to take him all over Australia. And this is where I slotted in, that luckily I was for a while the primary driver and person that went with him.
Just tell me about some of the people you met on these trips, the people that really stick in your memory. You mentioned before you went, you know, towards the east or west coast of Tasmania, some of the more remote parts.
Oh, this was later years. John and I mainly covered New South Wales and Victoria. People, the Bulch brothers from Mystic Park, their property was called Bugger Castle. We celestials come from China, land of pigtail, lank and long, where the ladies' feet are tiny and they smoke the opium strong. Music hall. It's the funniest day I have ever spent in my life. And we took him to the National Festival. And Graham McDonald, a mate of mine who works at the Film and Sound Archive, he was the program manager at the National Festival there. And he said, you're bringing these blokes in. They perform locally. And John Williamson was the big catch. And John Williamson knew the Bulch brothers. He said, they were old blokes when I was a kid. when he was at Combatook. So McDonald, in his wisdom, decides to put the Bulch brothers on with John Williams at the main concert. Oh, jeez, you know. And because I had to ply them with whiskey. It cost me a fortune. And I was talking to another mate who actually brought them down, Stewie Sims from Lake Charm. And I said, oh, God, I said, it cost me a fortune to get the, to keep the vultures up with whiskey. He said, what do you mean? He said, it cost me a fortune too. So these blokes are up there. They've got the underpants hanging out of the... And they slayed them singing racist and sexist songs. And then John Williamson got up and played the ukulele with them. So these are the people, you know. It was just quite amazing.
Getting their whiskey from two different sources.
Oh, yeah.
So after a while, Meredith decided he wanted to retire, and you went solo because you were still loving what you were doing, and you were continuing giving stuff to the National Library. You've gone beyond recording music. What are you more broadly interested in recovering now?
Wow, everything. The music is always there. I love my music, and I love going into Indigenous. We did a lot of work with the Cape Barren Indigenous community. Oh, story. How they learnt guitar over there, because no one ever showed them how to play guitar. And I said, Ronnie Summers, one of the elders, Ronnie, how did you? He said, well, we learnt to play the guitar, and he said, then we learnt these chords. He said, this one's over the top, which was a G, which was the position your hand was on, and this one's a flat one, which was an A, and then he said, this one's Hank's chord, because Hank Snow plays that one. So, you know, you're playing the three chords. You're playing over the top, the flat one, and Hank's chord.
So you got D, A, and G, and that's your three chords, and there you are.
They didn't know them by any other name, but this again is part of this folklore. It's quite amazing. So that music is still there, and it's always a lovely part. All I won't say all, but the majority of the older players have gone. Those that were playing the fiddles, the concertinas, all the rest of that have gone, unfortunately.
Yeah, after a while you realised you were sort of finding out a lot of blokey history, and there was a missing bit, women's history.
Oh,
how did you pursue that?
Oh, of course. Again, in a country town you realise that to be a good farmer you marry a school teacher or a nurse so that they can subsidise. And my wife, of course, was a school teacher, and I knew that several of the teachers there. So I made a conscious decision. It was about 15 years ago we started a project called Voices of the Bush, and I made a conscious decision then to get the stories of the women. We did the drought, and the thing that got me was, yes, they were looking after their husband, yes, they were concerned about their husband, but the garden, that garden that they had nurtured for so long had died. So I started to look aside, and the opportunity came up to do the Bringing Them Home project. For three and a half years, I think, we did that. And that was to go into Indigenous communities and talk with people that had been separated. Of course, with any oral history project, you get a balance as well. So we talked with the administrators. But that was fascinating. I love working in Indigenous communities.
What did you find out from that project, the Bringing Them Home project? Was that part of the report that was prepared?
As part of the report came out, the National Library, and this is online, if you go into our... just Google Trove, T-R-O-V-E, which is the National Library search engine, Bringing Them Home, and a lot of these recordings are online. You can listen to them.
What was it like to hear those stories? Because they're, you know, it made Kim Beazley weep in federal parliament.
Oh, I have too, many occasions. Yep.
Up in Queensland, you went to Texas. Texas, Queensland, and met the DeBortoli family, not related to the winemakers, a different family. Tell me about them.
Tobacco farmers. In Texas, yeah. We were actually stopping at the Yellow Rose Guest House in Texas, which was owned by Russell Ward, the historian. There you go. And we went out and we talked to Lucia and Dom, her husband. And we were sitting in the kitchen. This is where we basically record a lot of our stuff, in the kitchen of people's houses. And Lucia told me the story that Dom and his family had come out from Italy in the 1920s. Now, Lucia's father decided to come to Australia in 1939, bringing his all but his wife and two daughters, Lucia being one of those daughters. And he was going to work on the tobacco and bring them out 6 months later. Now, 1939 was not a good year for a young Italian man to come to Australia. And he was interned.
Two breaks out, of
That's
course.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. He was interned, right?
Interned. And 13 years before Lucia got out. Now, on the other side, on the musical side of the story, was that Lucia had learnt a lot of these songs in her hometown in Italy, a lot of these old traditional Italian folk songs, and it was being preserved in Texas by with Lucia. But Dom and his brother Val loved Tex Morton. And they were playing these Tex Morton runs.
It's like a tarantella, isn't it?
Yeah. But it fitted beautifully with Italian traditional music. But Lucia had a lot of wonderful songs.
I've got a recording here that you made with her, and she's talking about one of these songs that I think she learned in Italy, or was it Australia? I don't know, about coming to Australia. And this is lovely. This is Lucia explaining what the song was about.
Lucia, what's this song?
It's Mamma Mia Dammi 100 Lire, which means Mother, my mother, give me $100 because I want to go to Australia. And the mother responds to the daughter or son, which case might have been, I will give you $100, but in Australia, no, no, no. Because if you go to Australia, you're in search of fortune and you never probably never come back and never see me again, which is a true story, as it happened with Val and Don's parents.
That's in a kitchen in Texas, Queensland, that we're hearing that?
That's in the kitchen.
In the kitchen.
At the De Bortoli's house. We recorded it there.
Give me $100 so I can come to Australia.
Yeah. And the mother says, no, no, no. If you do, I will never see you again. And as she said, this is what happened to a lot of the people that came out. They never saw their parents again.
That's striking gold, hearing that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's these groups of nationalities all over Australia that have these songs.
The Germans in South Australia, Italians in North Queensland.
Yep. The Swiss in Perth. There's a Swiss community in Perth. But it's not only the songs that we're recording. And I'll get back to this reason why it is so important, is that the songs, the traditions are brought out to Australia. And the home country moves on, whereas because of isolation and a small community out here, we preserve these stories for the rest for the nation itself. Cultural lag, and it's there. But wedding traditions, wedding songs, funeral songs, food law. Oh boy, we had some nice tucker. Hey.
Yeah, it's amazing going into some of these towns in North Queensland and eating some of the best Italian food you've ever had in your life, isn't it? In country Queensland.
Yeah. I was up in Cairns doing some work for the Forgotten Australians project about a month ago, and there's a little enclave of Italians up there that I must get back.
My guest today is folklorist Rob Willis, and Rob's been collecting stories, songs, folklore from Australian culture going back, nearly 200 years pretty much, isn't it? Really, Rob, it goes back that far, and it's all in being held in the National Library, and it's available for you to enjoy yourself. Now, you were a bit ahead of the pack collecting child migrant stories, weren't you, Rob?
Yeah, that was interesting in itself, that we'd done the 3 years of the Bringing Them Home project, and living in Forbes, I go to Sydney quite often, and at Molong, a little place just out of Orange, there was Fairbridge Farm. And, you know, you're driving there and to Fairbridge. What's this all about? Oh, child migrants. Wonder what that is. I've just done 3 years of Indigenous separation. What about white fella separation? I'm a quizzical little fella. So I got in touch with the Child Migrants Trust in Melbourne. And they told me about this, and I started to record the stories of the child migrants.
This is before the leaving of Liverpool and such stories.
The leaving of Liverpool was just about that same time, and I thought again that we've got to sit down with people. We've got to sit down with people and talk to them.
Once you're finding these stories, it must be very emotional. I mean, people as they recall these things must break down and weep as they tell you about them. Mm.
I got a great mate, Colin Wilson. Better known in local circles as Blue the Shearer. Blue's in his mid-80s now. But in a former life, Cole was the head of DOCS or FACS or whatever it happened to be that particular week, Department of Community Services. And he had a great area from Broken Hill to about three-quarters of New South Wales. And we're talking about his staff. I interviewed him actually for the Bringing Them Home project because they were dealing with Indigenous matters. He's talking about the people that he had working for him. He said, there's two types, Rob. He said, there's those that go in for the money and then there's the bleeders, those that feel. Oh, I'd like to think I'm a bleeder.
A bleeder indeed. There's on a recent episode of Radiolab, I heard this theory about country music. American country music is popular in places where you think it couldn't possibly be popular, in parts of Africa and India, and it's huge in Ireland, of course. And they ask themselves the question, why does this really seem to strike a chord? And there's a theory behind it, in that country music speaks of the separation. It's really about going to the city. And these are songs of being separated, of kind of homeostatic life, where life moves with the seasons and it doesn't essentially change from year after year after year. And then you go to the city and you're thrust into the modern world and you miss it. And that's why you hear this almost like a wail in country music. And you hear it in Hank Williams, this kind of cry. And the country musicians call it a baby wail or a cry in the voice. Are you hearing that in the music you're picking up?
That's an interesting one, because when I was doing the Bringing Them Home project, of course, the music comes out. And within Indigenous communities, music is such a big part. And I'll never forget one of the first interviews that I did, or first yarns that I had with someone in West Wyalong. And he was very keen on country music, the music of Jimmy Rogers and all of that stuff, this feeling that you're talking about. And I said, Bill, why do you like this music? What is it about it? And he said, that's the way we feel. So whether that comes out, and you hear, there's a great fellow by the name of Dougie Young, who's an Indigenous singer in far west New South Wales, and in those songs you hear exactly what you're talking about. You know?
Is this a dead culture we're talking about now, sadly? Is it disappeared for good now that, you know, you can go into a lot of country towns now, there's not, you know, there's a DVD shop, and that's what culture is, sadly, in too many towns in Australia, where people will go and get a DVD and take it home and watch there, rather than sit around the piano and sing as they might have done in the past. Is this a dying thing you're recording?
There's a lot less of it. Dying, I hope it never dies. While ever we've got a protest movement, that's one of the areas that I am very interested in is, of course, environmental protest songs. And there's some wonderful stuff. I remember sitting in the headquarters of the in Hobart with the people that were at the Franklin blockade and getting their stories and then getting to sing a song. So you had that combination of those, here we are in Risdon jail, hoping no one will pay our bail, that sort of thing, you know. So they're still there. An environmental protest with the fracking that's going on. There's some great songs. I'm not going to go there, but there's some great songs.
You can have a lot of fun with that word in the song, can't you? So these older songs you've been keen to preserve, are they still being played, though? Are they still being performed?
Not to the degree, perhaps, that they were. We had this bush band revival in the 1970s, the Bushwhackers, Cobbers, a whole stack of stuff like that. What I would really like to see, again, is some of these old songs taken and a different spin put on them. Make them bush blues or something, you know.
Pick up and run and transmute it into something else.
Yeah, but to create an interest. That's what created an interest with me with a lot of this stuff, that it wasn't someone playing the way that it was originally intended, but it was someone putting a bit of life into it. And from that vitality of that music, from that song, then I thought, ooh, I wonder where that came from. And then you go back and try and find a source. But it has to be interesting.
Are people still coming to you with stuff? Do you need to find them so much now, or are they coming to you now?
I hope the people will still contact me. This word of mouth, this networking, is indeed a wonderful thing.
And what are you working on now?
I'm working on a project, a great bloke who's in midget submarines. I'm working with the Submarine Institute of Australia on the Submariners. A project on men's sheds, voices of the bush, Paralympians, a bit of everything.
Everything you do seems to be embedded in the whole idea of the power of story. Everything seems to be embedded in that.
Yep.
I'm sort of taking the view that a digital culture is leading to a huge revival in this, because you can find it much more easily.
Oh, look, the National Library are fantastic, and the staff where I work at Oral History are just the most amazing people. And getting it out there is so vital, and they're doing it. They're doing it. Hop onto the website.
Yeah. Now, what's the best way to find some of this music? And because a lot of people listening to this will recall some of the songs you've been talking about and would love to be able to find what you've got. How can they find it through the National Library's website?
Just search for Trove, T-R-O-V-E, which links all the collections, the pictorial, oral history and the whole thing, and then just search with wonder, whatever. You'll get lost for hours.
Are you going to keep doing this till you fall over?
Oh, Rob? Till they got to carry me away, I think.
They carry you away. That's fantastic. I don't know if I got you to do this, but you offered to sing a little ditty before you came on today. Do you want to go out with something that you might want to share?
There's the parody of Gundagai that probably is the most parodied Australian song. There's a scene that lingers in my memory of the time I went down to the sea. Someone stole my trousers, I hid amongst the houses down at the beach at Old Bondi. When the policeman came and found me, I'd the evening news around me and some girls were passing by. And it gave me quite a shock, they put me in the dock. I said I came from Gundagai. Well, the magistrate looked at me and he said, how old are you? I looked at him quite proudly and I said, I'm 22. Well, he looked at me and said, you'll be 23 instead when you get back to Gundagai.
Beautiful. What a great way to end it. Fantastic to meet you, Rob. What a pleasure it's been speaking with you today. Thank you so much for being my guest in conversation.
And thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.